You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Frankie Barnhill, filling in for Gemma Gaudette. Welcome to Friday and our reporter roundtable. Today I'm joined by Madeline Beck of Boise State Public Radio News and the Mountain West News Bureau, along with Kevin Richard of Idaho Education News and Don Day of BoiseDev.com. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hi there.
Happy Friday.
Indeed. Well, it was another tumultuous week in Idaho as the state, you know, continues to struggle against the coronavirus. While there are some signs that hotspots in the southwest part of the state are beginning to slow down in new cases, hospitalizations are up, and another 26 fatalities were reported by the state since Sunday. Governor Brad Little announced yesterday that the state would once again remain in stage four. And Kevin, with that backdrop, schools are trying to reopen. Take us back to Monday when there were three big meetings about schools, one from the Central District Board of Health, the next from West Ada Schools, and a third that was supposed to take place, and you can tell us about that, with the Boise District. What happened?
Yeah, how much time have I got here?
Yeah, right? I know. Let's start with the Central District Health and then pivot to the schools and how they interpreted that.
Okay, let's blast through this thing as quickly as we can. So the Central District Health came out on Monday with its first round of categorizations, classifications for the coronavirus and as it affects schools. And what Central District Health said was that all of Ada County and all of Ada County's schools are under substantial coronavirus spread. That's not a surprise to anybody. Anybody who's been watching these numbers.
Right.
But what it means is that the health district is recommending that schools remain closed under that scenario, that you go only to distance learning. Well, on Tuesday, we had the two largest school districts in the Treasure Valley, the two largest school districts in the state, decide what they're going to do for the fall. Boise's decision was fairly cut and dried. They decided to go online only when schools start on the 17th, and they're going to stay that way at least until after Labor Day. West Ada is a lot more complicated. The only concrete thing that West Ada did this week was that they delayed the start of the school year. School will start on September 8th, the Tuesday after Labor Day. It was supposed to start on the 27th. What school looks like on September 8th is really open to debate. Trustees wrote in some language into their back to school plan that would allow the schools to open perhaps on an alternating every other day basis, even during this substantial coronavirus spread, even though the health district is recommending schools be closed. They worked that language into the back to school plan. Then Thursday, the district kind of walked back off of that plan and said what they really have in mind is perhaps to open for small sessions. Maybe special needs students are allowed back into the schools, or English language learners, or advanced placement students, or career technical students. So it's hard to figure out where West Ada is going to be, and trustees will meet again towards the end of the month to decide what to do. So we'll be watching for that.
Right. And we should mention, with that postponement in West Ada, what are they trying to do? I mean, they're trying to buy themselves some time. And what do they hope to have happen, either things that are in their control or not in their control, between now and then?
Well, I suspect they're trying to buy time on a couple of levels. And you're absolutely right. The most obvious reason they're trying to buy time is that they're hoping that the coronavirus case numbers taper off in Ada County. And there are indications that the new case numbers in Ada County are starting to slow down. They're not low by any stretch of the imagination, but they are starting to slow down a bit. But I think also West Ada's got to buy some time for themselves, because they're in the middle of trying to acquire computers so that students can have an individual computer to work on from home. They're expecting on the order of something like 10,000 computers that they have on order.
Wow.
That they don't expect to get until towards the end of the month or early September. Then they've got thousands of cases for these computers that are on order. So it's like Best Buy, only bigger. And they have to figure out how to get all these computers ready for students. And I suspect that, you know, part of the reason you want to slow down a bit is to, you know, get some of this equipment in hand and get some of this equipment ready to distribute to students if you have to go online.
Wow. Well, and of course, you know, all of this is new territory for everyone, but I do wonder, is there an example, some parts of the country, other states have started reopening schools already. Is there an example of a school district either somewhere in the United States or in the world that you know of, Kevin, that's kind of taken this blended approach and that it's been successful?
I think you're going to see a lot of examples of blended learning or online learning around the country. I mean, a lot of large districts are going the online only approach or the blended approach. You had in the open New York talking about planning to reopen schools because their coronavirus case numbers have dropped so much. But I think in a lot of large districts around the country, especially in the West, where you know the coronavirus numbers are still rising and the outbreak is still pretty substantial, you're going to see online learning or blended learning.
Mm-hmm. And I was reminded on Wednesday during our doctor roundtable by Dr. David Pate, who's on the governor's coronavirus task force and formerly of St. Luke's, he mentioned, you know, that we're the only country seeing this uncontrolled spread. It's going back to school. So again, all of this is new for everyone and is really, really challenging, to say the least. I want to pivot just a little bit to Boise schools. You said their plan is pretty cut and dry. One thing is the deadline, I believe, was for today for the online option that was online only that Boise schools was giving to parents. I think your colleague Sammy Edge wrote about that. What the district is talking about with doing these first 2 weeks of online learning is different. Is that right? It's set up slightly differently?
Exactly. And I think it's important to kind of help listeners understand the difference. So when I talk about Boise starting online for everybody, that means that regardless of what parents have decided to do, every student is going to start from home on the 17th. Now, the 4,000 students you're talking about and counting, because the deadline is, well, the deadline was noon today, so I don't really know what the final number is going to be. Mm-hmm. You have 4,000 kids who have been registered into Boise's version of online school. And what that means is that parents have decided, for safety reasons or maybe just to have some sort of, you know, assurance of what's going to be going on from week to week, you know, month to month, they've decided to keep their kids home in the online program for at least the fall semester, maybe for the entire school year. That's 4,000 kids. That's a large school district in and of itself.
Yeah.
So the Boise district is really scrambling to figure out, well, who's going to teach all these kids? And you know, how are we going to staff this new online school district that's that they're starting from scratch? It is a big undertaking. I mean, we talked about the big undertaking West Ada's got with all these computers coming in. You start a school district with 4,000 kids and they're all working from home. That's a big job.
Yeah, wow. And at least, as you mentioned, because those were numbers from earlier this week. And of course, parents, I took a look at the sample schedule for Boise School District, and they said for younger kids to expect that parents need to work basically side by side with them for at least 4 hours a day.
Yeah, it's daunting. It's pretty demanding what they're expecting from parents. And you know, that kind of gets to a bigger issue about online learning, is that it's not for everybody. It's not for every household, because not every family has a parent who can work from home or a parent who can work pretty much part-time to full-time with their kids. It's tougher in some households than it is in others. It's tough in every household, but if you're a single parent or if you work a job that you can't do from home, online learning is a really difficult thing to try to pull off.
Right. You're tuned to Idaho Matters and our Friday Reporter Roundtable from Boise State Public Radio. Kevin, we've also, of course, here at Idaho Matters, we get emails from teachers and parents and comments on Facebook and Twitter. So many fraught decisions that families are having to make right now, let alone teachers and administrators. What is the state doing to help districts wade through these decisions from a financial standpoint, from a resource perspective, through the CARES Act?
Yeah, I was really curious at the messaging on Thursday from the governor. I think what Governor Little was trying to convey was a sense of control, a sense of we've got this and we're putting money into it. None of that money is necessarily new, Frankie. This is money that has been approved in the past, but it's money to, you know, try to bridge the digital divide for for students who don't have computers or don't have home internet. It's money for testing for teachers so that they can be tested as they go into the classroom. I think what the governor was trying to convey was the sense of that he still expects schools to open, and he expects that any closures are going to be short term. But, you know, that messaging really runs counter to what we're seeing in the Treasure Valley, and just in the Treasure Valley, because when you think about West Ada and Boise and Nampa that's going all online, and CUNA and Valley View and Caldwell that are doing sort of a blended approach, that's 100,000 students in the Treasure Valley alone who are going to begin the school year either completely online or at least part of the time online. That's a third of the students in the state. So the messaging from the governor about this reopen, some schools will reopen, and I think you'll probably see it maybe more in smaller districts and rural communities that haven't been hit as hard so far by coronavirus. But you're seeing school districts, big school districts in the Treasure Valley, going a very different route than what the governor is talking about.
And Madeline, I want to bring you into the conversation. You did a story this week pivoting a little bit from the conversation on K through 12 to higher education. You've been reporting on this Yale study about testing needs for colleges, coronavirus testing needs. What did you learn?
Yeah, and the study itself wasn't specifically about testing needs to start. It was basically asking the question, how can we safely reopen college campuses? Or can we safely reopen college campuses? And so researchers with the Yale School of Public Health delved into that, and they created a mathematical simulation based on a campus with 5,000 students, where 10 are asymptomatic carriers of COVID-19. And so you have that simulation, and they played out a range of scenarios of looking at how we know it can spread. And then they played in how many people are wearing masks and what kind of distancing is used. And they found that, yep, you need to have distancing, you need to have masks. But beyond that, you need to have potentially tests for every student and every person on campus every 2 days.
Wow.
That's a lot of tests. And they're like, you know, that's what our simulations say is the safe way to reopen campuses. And so basically, and obviously that comes into play of like, okay, so where are they going to get these tests? How expensive are these tests going to be? Where are they going to send these tests when labs, especially private labs, are already becoming overwhelmed? And so, yeah, you run into that. He did say that they were suggesting rapid testing that might be a little bit less sensitive of tests. You might be getting a few more false positives, but that he recommends still testing every 2 days. And so he acknowledges some schools are not going to be able to afford that. Mm. They estimated costs of between $120 and $910 per student per semester. Some schools might have the money for that, others don't. But he says, you know, we shouldn't conflate something that's not practical with something that's not important.
Right.
So it's like, well, if we can't afford it, then should we reopening at all is the question that he's asking. One of his colleagues did another study earlier with another mathematical simulation. They found something similar, testing every 3 days. And then there was a little pushback from some others that basically said like, well, if we integrate both some online and some in person and do these specific protocols, we think we need to test a little less. But even if you're testing every student once a week, which these studies find is not enough, even if you do take it down, that's still a lot of tests. And do we have the capacity for that?
Right, right. And it's a pipeline of capacity. It's not just the materials themselves, it's the labs, all of those different steps. I wonder, Kevin, I believe that this summer, there was earlier on the summer before the big surge in Ada County, there was conversation from Boise State University thinking that, you know, we'd like to have tests available for everybody when they return to campus, but they have stepped away from that because there just isn't the testing available to the university. Are you aware of other schools in other higher ed institutions in Idaho and how they're approaching the question of testing regularly or at all?
I think what you're seeing right now are some partnerships that are emerging. U of I has a partnership with the hospital up there to do testing for students. And Boise State has announced that they've got a new testing program that's going to be in place. It's a partnership with the two main hospitals. and with the VA. And I believe that President Marlene Trump has talked about that this is going to provide about 4,000 tests daily. But that doesn't get you to that every other day testing recommendation that, that Madeline was talking about from the Yale study. I mean, if you're testing every other day at the Boise State campus, and we're talking about 25,000 plus students, you got to be running 12,000 plus tests per day to get there. So these partnerships are going to bridge some of that gap, but it's probably not going to be optimal relative to what's being recommended by Yale.
Right. Don, I would love to pivot away from COVID-19 related news just for a moment.
Can we just pivot away from COVID-19 forever?
Can we pivot away from 2020? Yes. I don't know.
Sadly, no.
Yeah, exactly. But I did want to talk to you about a story that you published recently in your publication about McCall and this question of state-owned endowment land and this controversy. It's always complicated when we're talking about public lands, but what's going on there?
To echo my colleague, Kevin Richard, how much time do you have? this is also pretty complicated. A private developer, newly formed, has put together a plan to essentially buy timberlands in North Idaho and then trade them for 28,000 acres of land in McCall. And if you think 28,000 acres of land sounds like a lot, that's the equivalent of 44 square miles. And it's actually 4.5 times larger than the city of McCall itself. And the plot of land includes like everything you kind of see up there, all the hills around the lake that are covered in trees and a lot of the land along the river and more. These lands right now are controlled by the Idaho Land Board. The Idaho Land Board is kind of a unique entity, and people call these public lands, but they really aren't. And I know Kevin has covered this for a long time. They're endowment lands, and the state has a constitutional mandate to make a profit off of endowment lands for education. And Kevin actually first reported on this earlier this summer, and then I tried to dive even deeper. And I talked to the developer. He's a guy by the name of Alec Williams. And he wants to put this plan together. His pitch essentially is these lands aren't public now. They are kind of being divvied up and parceled off one piece at a time. There was a proposal to sell off the land on Cougar Island, which is one of the few significant islands in the lake. And he says, hey, you know what? Here's my idea. I'm going to buy these lands in North Idaho. I'm going to trade them. I'll get control of these. And we will put together a plan that will put the large majority of these into a conservation easement. Hmm. We'll develop a few parcels, and it'll be good for everybody. Hmm. Well, that's not how people feel about it. The reaction to this proposal, which we don't really even have all the details to, have been pretty negative. More than 500 comments came into the inboxes of McCall City Council. And I've covered Boise City Council for a long time, and I don't remember 500 comments coming in on just about anything. So in the city of McCall, that's really significant.
Right.
Initial testimony of the land board has been negative. The Idaho Wildlife Federation is out with a petition. The Idaho Conservation League is out in opposition. There was even a protest on the streets of McCall. Where this goes, we'll see. They were going to present in front of the land board in July, and they pulled it back. And I think that the blowback has been pretty significant. And, you know, we're in a time right now where people don't trust things. And even if everything that the developer says here comes to pass, I think people are very nervous about anytime you're going to say we're going to change the status of such a large piece of land in Idaho, in a place that so many Idahoans love.
Right. And especially up in that region that has seen, well, yes, these are technically endowment lands owned by the state, but just in general, the idea of land moving from the state to a private entity with the most publicized and well-known example being the Wilkes brothers, these billionaires from Texas who bought some public land, and now that land people were used to access and they don't have it anymore. So you're right. It does get to all of these questions.
Yeah. And I think it's important with the Wilkes brothers, they didn't actually buy public land. They bought privately owned land,
right.
But there had previously been an expectation of public access.
Great distinction.
And the folks,
yes.
Yeah. And Alec Williams and the folks at the company he's founded called Trident Development have actually used that as a talking point, and their website says something to the effect of, our goal is simple, do the opposite of what the Wilkes brothers have done. Mm-hmm. But, the thing that I hear from folks up there is like, okay, that's great. We could take him at his word. But what if somebody buys him out? What happens in 60 years? And I did a podcast with him where we talked for, about 45 minutes. And if people are interested in this, I think it's really interesting. I also wrote 2,000 words on it. And even that isn't deep enough, frankly, to get into all of it. It's a very complicated issue. And anytime that you talk about the land board in Idaho, I think people go, the what board?
Right.
What is that? How does that work? And it's a complicated thing. I think the bottom line for folks is there's going to be some sort of change. The land board has decided to start a review process of how it manages those lands up there and what it does, because they kind of have taken a piecemeal approach. The most famous example is the cottage sites on Payette Lake and, help me, Kevin, Priest Lake?
Yes.
Yeah, Pete Priest.
Yep. So those cottage sites have been in the news for several years. And I'll just disclose that my family formerly owned a cottage site. We don't anymore, or leased that cottage site. But there's been a lot of consternation up there. And I think the land board has started to recognize that it needs to figure out something that will be a long-term play for this part of, you know, and this is an issue that you talk to just about anybody on the streets of Boise, on the streets of McCall. People love that region, and it is the beating heart of Idaho in so many ways. And that comes out when I talk to people on all sides of this. They say, boy, you know, like the governor was like, you know, I got married up there in the pouring rain, and everybody just loves McCall, and anything that could change that character makes people a little nervous.
Right, of course. We'll definitely want to follow that story. I've done a little bit of reporting on the land board, and yeah, it's a really complicated and interesting function in Idaho, to say the least. I do want to pivot back to the State House then, Kevin, with an announcement from the governor about a special session for later this month. Sounds like we're going to learn a little bit more later for more details, but what do we know so far about what will be covered in this special session, especially as it relates to education?
Yeah, we've got a lot to learn about this special session. What we do know is that the governor is going to lay out a little bit more of a framework the week of the 17th, and that the session will take place the week of the 24th. What we don't know is exactly what is going to be on the table. And you know, special sessions are different than regular legislative sessions, in that the governor calls these special sessions, and there's a specific number of topics that the legislature can take up. And the legislature, according to the Constitution, cannot go rogue and decide to come up with new topics along the way. So we expect that the special session will deal with liability issues, with civil liability as it relates to COVID-19. That's a big concern for our educators. It's a big concern for school administrators who are worried that they could get sued if, and frankly, when a coronavirus case is tied to a school. Their liability insurance carriers have said that you're on your own. You're not covered. So that's definitely a concern, and I'm almost certain that that's going to come up in a special session. There will probably be legislation related to the November election. Those are starting to take more shape, I suppose. There may be other education topics that come up. The education committees have met, but they really haven't come up with anything terribly concrete. It's pretty amorphous, and I've got to imagine that the governor is not going to want amorphous in a special session. I think he's going to want a pretty clear sense of what's being proposed, does it have the votes to pass, and is it something we absolutely really have to do between now and January, that it can't wait until 2021 when the legislature comes back in full. So we don't know that. We don't even know the logistics right. of how the session is going to work.
Yeah.
How many legislators are going to be on the House floor or the Senate floor? How many are going to be working remotely from their offices? How many will actually be in the State House? The legislature that has about $1 million, a little bit more than $1 million to spend on technology upgrades to allow for remote operations, with the idea that it could be used for a special session. So I don't know what's going to be on the table. I don't know what it's going to look like, but we'll have better ideas hopefully in the next week or so. And we know that the week of the 24th is when whatever happens is going to happen.
Right. And Madeline, as Kevin mentioned, the conversation around elections might be part of this special session. And you looked into this a little bit as far as mail-in ballots and when people should fill those out if they're going to do those absentee. What did you hear? What did you learn?
Right. So what we are seeing right now is the U.S. Postal Service has cut some costs, and that is what many are seeing around the country is some backup of mail. And so that's really concerned people regarding mail-in elections and mail-in ballots, because they're like, well, if there's backups, like how are we going to get it in? And in states like Idaho, you have to have your mail-in ballot back in by election night. So what the U.S. Postal Service has recommended is you request that ballot no later than 15 days before the election, and you send it back in no later than 7 days before the election. In Idaho, by law, you can request your ballot as late as 11 days before the election. But then you're just playing that game of, well, when is it going to get here? And am I going to have time to send it back in?
Right.
There is an alternative. At least in Idaho, what I heard from the Secretary of State's offices is they've checked with a lot of different polling stations. And if you got a mail-in ballot and you just want to hand deliver it to your elections office, you can do that. They're going to be setting up, he said there was all sorts of creative solutions for boxes where people could drop off their ballot in a secure location, whether it's been cemented in or it's been chained to a door, all of these different solutions that are happening. So if you're worried about getting it in, you may want to just hand deliver it just to be safe. But overall, they're saying, please don't procrastinate. Please don't wait till 11 days before to request your ballot. Please don't even wait till the 15 days before to request your ballot. Request it now, request it as soon as possible, and get it back in as soon as possible so we know it's voted. We know from the primaries that we have seen an overwhelming use of mail-in and absentee balloting. And now looking at how intense it was during the primaries, I have a feeling it's gonna be even more so during the regular election coming up here in November 3rd.
Right. And with that special session, one of the things that might get talked about if it gets on the docket officially is Ada County Clerk Phil McGrain has been talking about how he'd like the ability for his folks to be able to scan mail-in ballots ahead of time before election night so that they're not having to deal with that, as well as, you know, staffing and everything that goes along with the in-person. So a lot to be figured out. We're going to come back with more of the report around Roundtable, because believe it or not, there's more to talk about. You're listening to Idaho Matters. On our reporter roundtable today, Madeline Beck of Boise State Public Radio News and the Mountain West News Bureau, Kevin Richard of Idaho Education News, and Don Day of BoiseDev.com. Before we turn back to our journalists, a few more headlines from this week worth mentioning. Adri Edmo became the first transgender inmate in the country to receive gender confirmation surgery through a court order. Governor Little had tried to block this from happening with a petition to the Supreme Court. That didn't come through in time. We went deep on this topic in our podcast, Locked. You can find that wherever you get your podcasts. You can read about her story, too, at BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. Also a story there about tourists from out of state flocking to places like Sun Valley and Stanley this summer during the pandemic. Again, find all of that at BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. Madeline, a story that you've done recently is about Project Echo. What is this project, if you can tell us quickly, and how is it helping rural medical professionals during the pandemic?
Yeah, to sum it up quickly, it's basically, you may have heard of a hub and spokes model where you have these hubs of like with really big hospital institutions that have a lot of specialists and a lot of researchers. And what this thing was created to do, called Project Echo, was for rural hospitals and rural doctors and rural healthcare providers of all kinds, really, they could video call in like once a week to get trainings on how to treat things that usually they'd send specialists to do. And this is really important because some people may not have the time or the resources to drive all the way in to see a specialist in a place like, we might not be able to drive all the way to Boise if you're way up in northern Idaho and that's where the only specialist for this particular issue is. Mm-hmm. So potentially that doctor could video conference in and get training on how to treat it themselves. This became a really big deal. It started in New Mexico because people had to drive all the way into Albuquerque to get treatment for something like hepatitis C. And people were dying because they couldn't have the resources or take the time to drive in to see these specialists. Now this has grown. It's grown to help those with drug addiction. And most recently, obviously, with COVID-19, it's grown precipitously. They already had this framework already set up. So now it's helping a lot of people really quick. Doctors are able to call in once a week. It also gives them their training credits that they need to stay licensed, something they aren't able to do now, to go to conference and get those educational credits. It does that, and it's helping people really set a baseline for how to treat this illness, what your ventilator settings should be, what the latest research is showing with different types of drug treatments, what's coming, and what do we do about these cases that we're seeing that we may not know how to deal with. So that's what Project Echo is in a nutshell.
Yeah. Well, thank you for getting us up to speed. We actually did interview some folks from Project Echo earlier this summer. I was glad to see your piece that dug into it a little bit more too. And yeah, it just seems like, you know, having that project already set up or this program already set up, wow, what a time to have it ready to go during COVID-19. Are people besides doctors, is it just people with MDs who are taking advantage of this? Or are there other medical personnel who are getting take advantage of this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have people, especially when they're talking about drug trials and different drug prescriptions and things, you have pharmacists, you have nurses calling in, you have social workers calling in. All of these people, they not only all learn from people giving presentations during these, but they also learn from each other. You get to cross boundaries, like maybe a doctor is wondering, how do I give an end-of-life discussion to someone who's in the hospital who can't see their family? How do I do that? So you might want to work with a social worker who might be on that call. Or you might be able to connect with someone that can help you. You can help them. It's everyone teaching, everyone learning, and everyone collaborating to figure out our way through this.
Yeah, wow. And of course, telemedicine has become so essential. And now this sounds like a very essential resource for those doctors administering healthcare in rural parts of the state, especially. Don, back to the Treasure Valley and specifically to downtown Boise. What's happening in downtown Boise, or rather, what's not happening in downtown Boise these days?
Yeah, as your producer Sam will tell you, I was just down there and it's pretty quiet. I ran a story, and I've been doing this periodically since the pandemic started, looking at the number of folks who are parking in the public parking garages owned by the Capital City Development Corporation. And while it's just one metric, it helps to give an idea of how many people are downtown and what's it look like, because it gives you that kind of data-driven slice of what's going on. And before this, before COVID-19 really started to have an impact in Boise, at noon in the middle of the week, which is their busiest time, 2/3 of all spaces had a car in them. That bottomed out in April at the same middle of the week, midday time slot, at 8%. It then started to tick up slowly but surely, and by June 17th, you saw some recovery with 30% of the spaces in use. And then that started to tick downwards again once the new stage three restrictions in Ada County took place, and it's kind of stuck right now at about 25%. You can see there's a graph on Boise Dev. You can kind of see that visually, but essentially what it shows is there's just a lot fewer people going downtown than were before. As most folks can imagine, that ecosystem is driven by lots of workers working in offices, and it doesn't take a long time of walking around downtown to sense that there just aren't as many people down there as there were before. Why does this matter? Well, there's a number of reasons. One, it's a big generator of property tax in the city. It's a big generator of sales tax in the city. And it really is kind of the hub of commerce in Idaho. It's also the seat of three different governments, Boise, the state, and the county. And where that goes in the future, I think, is going to be a really big question and its impact on the Treasure Valley and really the state as a whole.
Right. And I do want to mention, Don, another thing that happened this week is Boise Dev is expanding. so tell us about what your coverage is going to look like moving forward quickly.
Yeah, we're really lucky. We have hired Margaret Carmel. She will join our team. And 6 months ago, it was me by myself. And now we're going to have four reporters working on the story of a changing Idaho. And I think it's really fun to grow journalism right now and add reporting. And, you know, like Boise State Radio, we're reader focused and reader sustained. And so I'm really lucky to have a good base and to be able to grow. And, you know, congratulations to Boise State Radio, since you're doing it to me. I'll just mention that in the latest radio ratings, Boise State Radio was number three, which is a big deal in this town against commercial competition. So there you go.
Yeah. Well, kudos all around. Yeah. And Kevin, I do want to mention, we didn't get to talk about an analysis you did on higher education and the pandemic and what it's doing to make a bad situation worse. We'll link to that on our website. So thanks to our panel of journalists today, Madeline Beck of Boise State Public Radio News, Kevin Richard of Idaho Education News, and Don Day. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Frankie Barnhill. You're listening to Idaho Matters.